This is part two of my chat with Jared Parsons about the C# compiler. In part one, we talked about what he does, what the team does, what the compiler is, how much work there is in implementing features, that there are no small changes to a compiler, the relationship between C# and .NET, and a bunch of other things. Hope you enjoy part two. Again, a slight change of topic. With every version of C#, it feels like there's a new way of doing something that I could do it before. And to me, it's hard to keep up.
Yeah, and I think when you look at that, there's kind of the new ways of doing things kind of falls into two categories. One of them is just deliberateness. C# is a 20-year-old language. It was designed in an era where languages erred on the side of ceremony. So C# is very explicit. Like, you go and you have a using for every single namespace that you're bringing in. You have public static class program, public static void main. And you have braces for everything. And at the time, that was very much par for the era that C# was designed in. But that was 20 years ago. If you look at languages that are a little newer, they tend to err a lot more on succinctness. And so if you look at your Rust, Go, Kotlin, they tend to very much say let's take a more minimalist approach. Let's remove the number of keystrokes and let focus more on the meat of the code that people are adding. And so there is a lot of movement in C# among our users who are saying, hey, I have to put a lot more keystrokes out for this than other languages do. How can we remove ceremony? How can we make the language more succinct without changing the expressiveness? And so that comes in a number of forms. We have expression body members, where instead of having if you have a very simple return statement, you used to have an open brace, you hit enter, tab in, return, some expression, enter, close brace. And now you can just do arrow 42 and it will return it for, it'll implicit return. It reduces a lot of the ceremony on very simple features. It's exceedingly common to use in properties, where with properties you used to have a brace, a get, another brace, a return, and now you just do arrow, return the value. It's much more succinct. And that is very deliberate on our part. It is trying to understand that times have changed and people would prefer a much more succinct way of writing their code. And we often will find features like that and we'll say, okay, this is a good trade-off for succinctness here, and we will do it. And that does end up with the challenge of there are two ways to do things now, and it does create a bit of style discussions. And then there are other, less deliberate ones would be a good example would be pattern matching. So pattern matching is something that C# started to add in about C# 7, where you can now do things you can say X is string S, where you can say is this actually a string and I want to put an identifier behind it? Or you can say is this a string? You can open a brace and say where the length is greater than 0. Pattern matching was added to the language because it's a very expressive and declarative way of inspecting data. It's something that is actually popular in a number of other languages. F# has very powerful pattern matching. And when you look at some of their code, it's that code is super readable. It's super expressible. It's very declarative in what it is trying to accomplish. And we added that to C# because we felt it would massively benefit customers. And it was such a big feature. It actually took us about 3 releases to get all of the things we wanted to do in there. And it's been a very popular feature and customers use it very frequently. But at the same time, it did have the downside of it now meant there are kind of two ways to do things. One I've put on Twitter a few times is oh, why are you saying string that is null or empty? Just say is string with length 0. It's actually less characters and you can do it this way. And it's a bit of a joke on my part. But for those type of things, it's an accidental way of giving people two ways of do things. But at the same time, we kind of had to do it to have this greater feature that we wanted. And for those, we just mostly tell customers, do what's comfortable for you. Do what's natural and what fits your scenarios best. There's no reason you have to use the new thing. You can keep using the old thing as long as you want. It's perfectly fine.
With some features, so in the last few days, the null parameter validation feature, which has been kind of talked about for some time, it's been, I think you've decided that it's no longer progressing.
Yeah. So that one has like a long history. So that one goes all the way back to like code contracts in the language. So C# has for a long time struggled with like, what do you do with argument validation? And there've been several variants of C# over the years. You have your Sing#, your Spec#, your Midori with its system C#. And you also have, and they've all kind of experimented with argument validation in some form. Like, how can we make argument validation a little more succinct and a little more easier for customers? Because like, if you look at traditional C#, you start a method body and you're like, okay, if X equals null, you know, enter, open brace, throw, new argument, null exception, close brace. And it's like, how can we, once again, get rid of that ceremony? How can we make that, that is such a common pattern, how can we just make that easier for customers? And as I said, this debate goes back 15 years in C#. You've also have MSR, Microsoft Research Department. They released the code contracts tool probably about like 10-ish years ago, where they actually rewrote IL to like add in a bunch of contract checks for you. And one, like all those experiments have had varying degrees of success. But like one thing they have all kind of found out is that null checking is like the most dominant form of argument validation. I remember I was involved in Midori in our experiments there, and we found we had applied our contract checking language to many millions of lines of code. And we found out that null checking was something like 95% of them. It was just an insane, like it was one of these, like when the person did the analysis told me the number, I told them they had measured wrong and they should let me see their code. That can't be true. That can't, like I put all this work to make it flexible in general. That can't be true. And then we looked at their code. It was true. And we have actually pretty consistently found that number over and over again, that of all the argument validation people do, an enormous percentage is null checking. And the next biggest case is making sure that numbers are greater than zero and less than length. And so the argument null validation feature we kind of put out recently was kind of an homage to that. It's like people have asked us for a long time, like make argument checking easier. And null checking is a sweet spot. And so we added this feature where you put 2 exclamation points after a parameter name, and we will insert all the null validation for you. And that was, and that had a lot of features. So we understood that that feature was going to be a bit controversial, mostly because it was controversial in language design. There was a lot of discussion on, is that worth adding to the language? Like, is adding a new feature here, a new way of doing things, is it that much better than typing the code out by hand? And we understood that that was going to be, that the community would likewise feel, you know, have a lot of controversy on like, is the syntax right? Is it worth adding the feature? And so we actually put that on preview deliberately. Like we actually had that feature completely ready and done, and we could have shipped it as a part of C# 10, but we deliberately said, no, we're going to put the pause button on that. We're going to ship C# 10. We're going to put this out in preview. We give ourselves a year, let the customers talk to us about, is it going to hit the sweet spot or not? And then we'll make a decision on it. And that is one, we got a ton of customer feedback on that, on the various aspects of it. And I think the feedback kind of lumped into a couple of different categories, one of which was, this is a new way of doing things. And I don't, you know, I prefer to just keep doing it the old way. There's a lot of feedback on whether or not the syntax was right, and also feedback on whether or not we should have done full contracts. And that one we ended up pulling because, we had put that out there because, like I said, there's a lot of controversy in language design about, like, is this the right feature or not? And we gave it to the community hoping that they would tell us. Like, you know, if you put it out in the community and the community is overwhelming, like, this is right, we love it, then, you know, other people in language design would have to, you know, say, okay, we were wrong. Like, this is actually more popular than we thought it would be. Let's remove our biases and let's move forward. But when we put it out to the community, we actually found that they were just as torn as we were on pretty much the exact same things that we talked about in language design. And at that point we said, okay, clearly this is not a universal win, and we need to kind of remove that. And that is exactly why we put out in preview, was to get that feedback. We got it. We said, okay, this is not it. And we removed it. Well, it'll be removed next week. We haven't actually undid it yet.
But it is nice to hear that you know, even though you've put in the time, the money, the effort, that, you know, with the best of intentions, you thought this is what people wanted. Maybe a smaller sample said yes, and then when you got it to a bigger point, and then people said, no, you're going fine. You know, we're taking the feedback. It's nice to hear that.
Yeah, and it's nice to good. Like, we've been moving to a model more and more now where when we kind of look at a language release, like we are at about a yearly cadence now, languages features can fall in a couple different buckets. Some of them it's like, okay, if we do that feature, we know how it's going to work. Like, there's really only a couple valid ways to implement that or express it. It's more of a question of should we do it or should we not do it. And then we have other features where we're like, you know, when we get down and dirty, like there's a couple of decision points in this feature that are really like we don't have a good intuition on. And for those features where we know there are more decision points, what we actually try to do is schedule those features sooner in the release. We put them out under preview, and then we go and tell customers, turn this on, tell us what's right, tell us what's wrong. And we use the feedback that we get both directly and indirectly, and people don't quite realize that they've opted into this, and they say like, hey, wait a minute, my code stopped compiling. And we're like, okay, that was a break we didn't think about. And we use that feedback to evolve the feature. And it actually has a huge impact on how we do things. So we definitely, customer feedback is a pretty important part of our language design process.
You know, it's I noticed in the release, or sorry, not in the release, in the recent blog post by Kathleen Dollard as well, there was discussion about the string literals, and I tried them out. So a problem I've struggled with C# is working with JSON. So I want to use JSON with Pulumi or with something else to configure some infrastructure as code, but I want to do string interpolation into that JSON, but it's a string and it's really hard to do it. And so I was quite excited when I saw it and I tried it out. And, you know, it's nice to see that is progressing too. I'm hoping that you continue with that one.
Yeah, that one, it's funny you mentioned JSON there. So that was a proposal that was done by Cyrus, who is a member of the C# IDE team. And I remember when he originally put the Borostein proposal up there, I kind of looked at it and I was like, okay, that makes things better. You know, I'm lukewarm, think this is a good idea. And I kind of read it and talked to him a bit about it. And then I immediately started doing a feature in the compiler where I had to write a whole bunch of tests that had JSON data in them. And I do string interpolation in them. Yeah. In about an hour, I went from, I'm kind of lukewarm in this feature, it seems like a good idea, to, Cyrus, why didn't we do this 3 releases ago? Like, can we get this done sooner so we can put it in so I can dog food and I don't have to do the horrible thing I'm doing with JSON literals right now? Mm-hmm. Things like JSON, it's like, perfect for, because it's the moment you try to interpolation, you're like, oh god, I have to go and escape like 40 braces now in order to make this work. That one is one that really, you know, it's an yet another way of doing things, but it solves a massive problem in the language we have today. And so we tell people, it's like, you don't have to use this if you don't want to, but when it's there, you're going to be really glad it was there.
Yeah, I ended up with 2 choices prior to this. So I had I don't know, I can't remember the name of it, but when you put the at symbol in front of the quotes in a string, what's that called?
Those are called raw strings.
Thank you, raw strings. You can then do string.format.
I don't even know the names.
String something equals at symbol open quotes. You can then put in your JSON, and then you can put in using string.format, you can kind of insert the things in, but you have to do it in the right order. So 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. It's awful. Another way that I came up with, and I have a blog post about it, is to use, you can put the raw JSON into a string or into a file, read it into Newtonsoft, and then you can kind of navigate your way through the properties of that JSON one by one. So you can go like server.operatingsystem.version.whatever, but it is painful. So I'm really excited about this one, because again, having used things like Pulumi and struggling with simply putting in a value I want, I guess if you're so strongly behind that this one won't be going away.
I would rate that as unlikely. That one was one where there was very little, like, when Cyrus started talking to people about it, there was, like I said, a little bit of like lukewarmness. Okay, it makes things better, but do we really need it? And then, like, as the samples and examples started coming in, like, it's not a question anymore of are we going to do this? It's more of, let's talk about some of the details. Like, there are things about, like, he's put an enormous amount of thought into, like, how indentation works and how white space, how do we trim white space on the left? And there's still some details we're working out in, like, the deep, deep corners about how certain crazy escapes work. But we're very much in the, like, how do we deal with these small little details thing. I mean, this was actually, like I said, it got so much support internally. Like, we started, like, looking at the Visual Studio schedule on, like, okay, how quickly can we finish this so that we can, like, check this in the Visual Studio so that we, like, we were timing how long until we can use it in the compiler code base, how long until we can actually start using our own code base, because we understand the benefit that it's going to provide. So I doubt that one is going away.
Well, that's good to hear. Back to kind of my questions I had, this one kind of came up on the side. How much does having to maintain backward compatibility hinder the language?
It's definitely a cost. There are some, like, it can come in a number of different forms. So generally, compat has gotten easier than it used to be. So back in the old days, like, if you go back, you know, 10 years or so, one of the problems we had is that we had no notion of, like, someone trying to use the latest version of C#. Like, people would buy a new version of Visual Studio, they get a new compiler, and the compiler always defaulted to what is the latest version of the language. And so compatibility at that point was a big burden, because every time you break compat, every time you say, like, well, we want to, like, we're doing this new feature, and if only we could evolve this, like, little corner of the language. Well, as soon as you evolve that corner of the language, like, anyone who buys Visual Studio and, like, moves to a new version of the compiler, they suddenly hit that compat break is in their face. It is applied to the code they've been using for 10 years now, and suddenly it doesn't compile. They get very angry. They don't want to move forward. It can inhibit people moving to, like, new tool sets. And it was a struggle, because it meant even, like, small things became magnified. Nowadays, the way it works is the C# language version is tied to the version of .NET you're targeting. So if you open up a classic .NET core project file, you'll see you're targeting, like, .NET 3, 5, 6, 7. Well, when you move that number forward, that changes the version of the language that you're using with it. And that has been a tremendous boon to us for compatibility, because we can now say, we can differentiate between people moving to a new compiler. They're like, I should get a new compiler. I don't want to change compatibility at all. I'm just, give me bug fixes. That's all I need. And people who are like, hey, I want to move to the next version of the language. I'm moving to .NET 6. I'm moving to .NET 7. And we can say, okay, great. As a part of moving to that new language, we have a couple of tiny things that we've changed that you might have to adapt to. Now, that has helped us in that it can allow us to have these corner cases where, like, oh, God, this is terrible. We wish we'd never done that. And we can attach those to new versions of the language. We still put a tremendous amount of thought into that. And, like, do we want to break compat? Because every time we break compat, it's a cost to customers. So in that way, it has freed our hand a little bit. So I'll give you a concrete example of where that helped us was when we did records in C#. So when we originally did records, the thing that we always wanted from the very start is we really wanted that nice, succinct declaration where you said record, point, open paren, in X, in Y, close paren. And that's because records are something that's, like, very established in programming languages. It's not something that C# invented. It's just something that we added to the language. And pretty much every language out there had that nice, succinct syntax, even like Java. Java had virtually that exact syntax. However, if you actually look at that, write it down as a language developer, you would say, oh, record. What if someone made a type called record? Like, that's a function signature. That's not a record declaration. And that actually was a hard ambiguity in the language. Like, it, and I don't mean hard and, oh, that'll be hard to deal with. I mean, it's like, it's a straight ambiguity that we can't fix. And there was really no way for us to fix that and maintain compatibility. But since we can now kind of, like, tick lang versions up, what we said is, okay, great. In C# 9, you can no longer define class record, because that would have blocked us from doing records. And we were able to do that And we only impacted people who are using a new version of the language. People who just got a new compiler, no problem. You can keep your class record. It's not going to bother you one bit. So that way, compatibility has gotten easier. But it is still a challenge. It is still something we deal with a lot. There are other parts of the language that are much harder for us. So like overload resolution and type inference. Those are areas of the compiler which a lot of people depend on. They are extremely complicated. And every release of the language, someone's like, you know, we could make this feature better if we just made a tiny little change to overload resolution. And those are like some of the most terrifying words to me as the compiler developer, because there is no tiny change to overload resolution. As I said, it's whenever you make a change to the compiler, two people have to sign off on it. You have to have two compiler people review it. If you change overload resolution, pretty much the whole team has to sign off on it, because we want as many eyes on that as possible. That is a place where compatibility, it is a challenge. It is something that we type inference and overload resolution is something that is where compat does hinder us to a bit. We have to spend a lot of time to make sure that we get that right and that we don't break people. That's very hard to tie to language versions.
What would it take for you to say, you know what, we're going to take a big step? Because, you know, if you look at .NET framework, there's a lot of code still out there, and that's fine. And then, you know, I started with .NET Core, I think at, you know, more seriously at version 2.1 and then 3, and then we leap to 5 and 6. I mean, it doesn't feel like there's a lot of connection between, let's say, what was written in framework and what has been written in, let's say, in 3.1 or 6. You know, is there any scenario where you would kind of take that leap and go, you know, to hell with it, we're cutting all of this stuff, you know, we're removing all the stuff that we've got better ways of doing, and you know what, you can stay with the older one, or you can come and join us on the newer one.
It would take an enormous, like pretty much every language, an enormous, like thing, pretty much every language which has done that has in some ways regretted it. Like yeah. Python 2 versus Python 3, like they broke compat, and you know, how many years on, they're still trying to convince people to go to 3. The problem is, like, it's, I think people who don't live in the space, they underestimate the value compatibility has to customers. I mean, you have millions of people who use the language. The language is 20 years old now. You have companies out there who are dealing with like big code bases. And when I say big, I mean millions of lines of code where they have half of it that they're not touching. Like, you know, Steven wrote that 10 years ago. He left the company. We don't know how it works. It just compiles and we ignore it. We're evolving the code on this side. We're evolving the code over here. We're not evolving the code over there. And if you tell them like, hey, like we're breaking compatibility, it's like, well, you force them. That becomes a tremendous cost on them because now they have to go and work in all this code that they don't want to work in. So it would take a lot. And actually what we have been starting to think about recently is kind of the opposite end of the problem. Like we do face significant challenges in the form of APIs that the .NET framework or ASP.NET Core have added over the last 15 years. Some of the, like for instance, when we did all the minimal API work for ASP.NET Core, we did evolve overload resolution because of how we made Lambda simpler and we changed their inference. And a lot of the struggle we ran into was not the language team saying, okay, we're going to make Lambda inference better. That means we have to change overload resolution a little bit over here. The problem we ran into was there are a lot of APIs that existed that were written 5-10 years ago that kind of fell into the little bit of a corner that the changes to overload resolution hit. And the presence of these APIs and the need for those frameworks to be compatible with the language forced the language to get more complicated. We're like, okay, it's not that we want to make C# more complicated. It's that the ASP.NET team or the framework team, they had this specific combination of overloads and we have to make them successful. So one thing we've been looking at more recently is working with them on ideas on how can we get rid of those APIs that are the problem? And instead of complicating the language, let's just get to the root of the problem. Let's let them move on from bad API. I don't want to say bad API decisions. They were all made in good decisions at the time that didn't foresee big changes to the language. And we've been talking about giving them a feature, for instance, where they can have an API that they mark and source. And it's like the compiler just ignores it. We will let you compile it. It will be there for binary compatibility. So when people upgrade from an old version of the framework to the new version, their code continues to run. But the compiler will just exclude it from the source when it compiles so that we can kind of like move on from that API. We can provide new overloads, which are better and fit new scenarios, and let the binary compat continue to work. And I think that is actually a direction we're likely to keep exploring the next few releases, is how can we let teams who have these strong compatibility, binary compatibility requirements, how can we let them move on from the decisions they kind of regret at this point?
Yeah, it's tricky. I remember as well in a conversation with Mads Torgersen that, you know, he was saying 20 years ago, string, it was thought that the future of communications across the internet was not going to be strings. It was going to be binary based. You know, and that's kind of bringing us back to our JSON discussion. And it was a very good faith decision. Yes, strings, that's not the future. So I understand what you mean. What about the yearly cadence? How much of a benefit is that to you? Yearly cadence of the release of new C# languages.
So it's an enormous benefit to us. So if you go back to like when I started, you know, 17 years ago, when like we were on like C# 3 or whatever, Visual Studio released like once every 3 years. And there was very little in updates in between those 3 years. Like the only thing we fixed in those kind of 3 years were like big, big, big bugs, like, you know, catastrophe. We used to joke like the bug has to punch the user in the face. Like it has to be so bad that we're going to risk like an update change to it, because Visual Studio only updated like probably 3-4 times in those 3 years. Like it had to be a bad thing. So when you get to the end of a release, when you were at that like 3-year horizon, when you're about to release, I mean, you sweated everything. Like every bug fix was life or death. Like if we don't fix this, like 3 years, customers have to deal with this, and then it becomes language law. Like we can't undo it. They're going to depend on this for 3 years. And I remember meetings where we were like, you know, the meetings between the people who are like, we don't want to make any more changes in the product because we want to ship. And the people are like, we don't want to live with this bug for 3 years. Like, how do we like, you know, how do we make a deal? Whereas now, the language ships every year. Like, you know, I mean, the 3-year horizon also for features. Like if I don't get this feature out, it's 3 more years until I can do it. Like maybe this feature won't be important in 3 years. Maybe I can't get that out anymore. It was stressful. Now with the yearly cadence, like if you miss a release, like it's next year. Like it's a much, the stress of like getting something in is so much lower. And honestly, it's like we have the major releases every year. Visual Studio updates 4-ish times a year, one of which tends to be major and 3 minors. Like even missing a bug fix now, it's like a much less stressful event for us, because we're like, oh, it'll be out in a couple more months. Like no big deal. Like we can, you know, if it's super, super bad, we can push and get it in. But for most of them, we're like, just fix it. You know, it goes on the ship train. The ship train will pick it up in a couple months and customers will have it and it'll be fantastic. And so overall, it's been a tremendous benefit in that respect, where it's kind of reduced a lot of the stress and it's made it a lot easier. Like missing a release is not as big of a deal as it used to be. It's like, okay, if it's not ready, you know, just hold it back. We'll get it in the next cycle. One of the jokes is I had a junior dev who reports to me one time. He's like, well, Jared, if I don't make this release, like it's going to be 6 months before anyone sees this. I was like, when I was your age, like it was 3.5 years. Like, you know, you should be happy with your 6 months. Like you don't know how bad it used to be. It has, the downside of the year release cycle is it means we don't have 3 years anymore to do features. Like we have to, if we're going to have a feature that stretches, like some features can't be done in 1 year. Couple of quick examples, pattern matching. The full extent of pattern matching we added to language could never be done in 1 year. Nullable reference types, generic math, none of those could be done in a year just because of the sheer volume of work that has to be involved. So the yearly cadence does mean that we have to put more planning into that and we have to be a little more deliberate about it. Some features we look at and we say, okay, we can't do this in a year. Could we break it up into kind of 3 milestones where each milestone delivers values to customers and gets us on that path to that final thing that we want to do, but it's an independent usable feature that we can ship? If so, okay, let's break it up. Let's kind of ship it over a couple releases in the language and just keep dropping value to customers. Some we look at and we're like, no, like generic math was an example. The individual features themselves aren't as compelling as having that complete thing that we want to give the customers. And particularly we're worried that if we kind of want to ship it all as one to make sure that we have all of the decisions that support that generic math thing, that we can change any of them up until the last minute, think of that whole beautiful feature out. That one was more challenging. We actually had to invent new concepts in the runtime for shipping preview features. We had to invent, the language was very comfortable shipping preview features, but like the runtime and the framework had no ability for shipping previews in RTM products. And so we had to do a lot of work with them to like make that a reality. But that's something we want to do more of in the future, is find ways for the runtime, kind of the .NET product, to give a feature to customers and say, hey, this is not ready yet. We want feedback, and we want to give ourselves the freedom to take a few years to do this correctly.
Yeah, I was going to mention that the previews seems like a fantastic thing now to get something that's not 100% there, or something that is 100% there, but you want feedback on. Because again, you know, thinking back on C#, the math one was something that in my podcast with Mads Horgeson, he was very excited about, that, you know, you can start using it and it works. Don't have any doubts about it, but we're not quite ready to say it's a full feature yet.
Yeah. One of the fun ones was sometimes we have the debate of like how many people are using these previews, because in order to do it, you have to use like a new version of Visual Studio, and you're going to have to turn on, like, we want to see like the Langver preview flag. Well, I get to tell people now, it's like, oh, we know how many people use the previews, because we inserted a bug into one of our preview builds that caused some crashes. And so I can tell you by the sheer volume of customer feedback, they're using the previews because we did a bad thing and they told us about it. So we're very confident that they're using the previews now. And it is an excellent source of, we can continue to think of that as an excellent source of validation for us.
How did the big move to open source affect your work or C#?
It affected it in a lot of different ways. One of which is, there are a lot of aspects in which it kind of changed things. One of it was it made our engineering better. So it's very easy to have engineering sins in your code base when you only have to justify it to about 6 to 8 people. You can do bad things and you just tell 6 to 8 people, oh, I didn't have time to make that better. It's a lot different when you're looking at a community of hundreds or thousands of people to justify the sins in your engineering. And so it will certainly make your engineering practices better. For instance, like we used to have a big adoption guide when people joined the team, like here's the to-do guide that you should read that was never up to date, that always had missing steps. Once again, you're only justifying it to one new person every other year. Now we have hundreds of people who are trying to clone and build and run our test. And the sheer volume of feedback of you missed this, you missed this, you missed this, it makes your engineering better. And you have to make your engineering better if you want people to participate. And so what is something people would always say is a good thing, like you should make it easy to like clone and build your code. When you're open source, it becomes very easy to invest in that because it's important for your success. The other ways it changed things is that it forced us to really increase like our documentation, and to be very very deliberate about how we did things. Like one problem we had when we first started is like we put the compiler out there and people started sending pull requests for language features. And we're like, what are you doing? Like, you can't do that. Like like language features are hard. Like, we don't do them a pull request. Like, you have to go through the language design, blah, blah, blah. And we were like telling customers, like we were creating friction because we were closing their pull requests saying, no, that's not how you do things. And they kind of came back to us and like, well, where have you told us how to do things correctly? And we're like, yep, you're right. Like we didn't do that. Like we had not laid out like this is how language design worked. And we actually went and it took a few days. We wrote a bunch of documentation and we put it up there and started telling people like this is how you do a language feature. Like you start with a proposal, you get language design to buy off and you move over here. And so that turned out to be very successful because instead of opening pull requests on the compiler, they started opening proposals on the language repo, which was fantastic. And it has actually evolved to the point where we now have a number of external people who are actually very comfortable with contributing code to the compiler. The other thing was it actually caused some interesting conversations with management. Like one thing I had to tell, we have a yearly review process. And one thing I started putting in my yearly review process for the people who work for me is how much time they spent reviewing code. Like I would say, like they shepherded this many PRs from the community in, or they spent like this, they helped this many other things happen, or spent this much time with the customer on this. And management was kind of like, what, why is this a part of, why is this something that you're kind of like putting out there now? It's like, well, like we have more people writing code now. Like we, like a big focus from my team, and this is something I actually had to talk with the team with too, like they write less code now that we're on GitHub because time is a limited resource. And if more people are writing code, we have to spend more time reviewing code. And for a lot of different reasons, core compiler team members need to sign off on every change. So if you have more external people who are writing code, the core compiler team has to spend more time reviewing code. And that's just a trade-off. And so I started putting the management's like, this is kind of a cost of going open source that we have to think about. It's like, my team is going to review more code. Like that's just how, if we want community to contribute, that is something that we have to both acknowledge and reward. This is something we need to think of in a positive light. And man, when I kind of explained to the management, like, oh, that makes, you know, complete sense. Like we understand why you're doing this now, but it was a big mind shift for like, basically all the teams ended up going through this thought process of, we are going to spend less time writing code now because we have to spend so much more time reviewing it and helping other people move forward. And it also was an interesting thing where I think some people kind of had this naive idea that you go open source and immediately like you amplify the amount of features you can do and the amount of contributions you can get. And we kind of had to tell management, it's like, it's a bit of a slower burn. Like in some ways we have a whole bunch of new interns who want to work on the code base. And we only have a limited number of people who can mentor those people and kind of teach them, you know, how our code works, how things go. And it was a bit of a slow burn to get people comfortable, particularly in the compiler. The Roslyn code base is, I think, 4 or 5 million lines of code. It's a very deep code base because you have kind of like the compiler, then the IDE, and then Visual Studio, and all the layers depend on each other. And so it took us a while to kind of mentor people and get a lot of people community comfortable with how to change the code, how to do the validations. But in the long run, it paid off massively for us. We have huge amounts of contributions from the community now that far exceed the amount of time we put into it. But it was a bit of a shift to like say like, oh, we're going to have to spend a lot of investment in getting people to this point.
Any negatives? Because like sometimes when people are exposed to the broad population, there can be caustic feedback, abuse, things like that.
Yeah. I mean, we do, that is something that another learning experience for kind of the whole team is like, how do we deal with trolls? How do we deal with abuse? And how do we kind of get like a coordinated team? I mean, there's both how do you deal with abuse and who deals with the abuse? Like not everyone is comfortable banning someone. Not everyone is comfortable like telling a random person on the internet, like play nicer, we're going to ban you. Like you need to kind of, you know, be a little more, you need to be nicer here. You need to be more respectful. And so we had to kind of like, as the .NET team overall, we kind of eventually, we have a small group of people now who are comfortable with having those conversations with people and comfortable identifying people, you know, the difference between someone who is just being disrespectful and we need to talk, and it's someone who is, it's a valuable person to work through and say, hey, you're being disrespectful. You need to be a little more respectful if you're going to keep being here. And people who are just there to cause problems and we just need to remove. Thankfully on the whole, we have not had a lot of that. Like we've definitely had some of that. We've had some people we've had to remove from the .NET organization, and that's unfortunate, but for the most part, it's been a good experience. The biggest problem is like the kind of the bigger challenge is kind of explaining like just basic resourcing realities to people when they say like, oh, this is so important to me and I really want to do this. And like, why have you like not looked at this issue in like 3 years? And it's like, you know, we have a limited set of resources. We have certain priorities and it's like, I understand this is very important to you and you feel very passionate about it, but, we actually, you know, it's just not on kind of our priority list here.
Yeah, it's exposure, effectively social media in a sense, but maybe with more accountability.
The other like real benefit that we got from open source was it put us in much more direct contact with our customers. Before, like we were on GitHub, if you wanted to like, if you say you thought you had a bug on the C# compiler or a feature, you'd go through like Visual Studio feedback, you'd file this thing that gets routed into like the big bucket of internal systems. Some contractors eventually like route that bug to our team. And then we can kind of make a ruling on it and, you know, say like, oh, this doesn't, you know, we can say like, this isn't a bug or whatever. We close it. And it can be very impersonal. It's like very abstract and disconnected. Whereas on GitHub, it's like, oh, at Jared Parr, like, have you seen this? This seems like a real bad problem. Like it is a very direct form of communication with customers. And overall, we love it. Like, we love being able to like talk to customers much more directly. Like, it's much easier for us to get a hold of them if we have follow-up questions that might be a little more sensitive in nature. Like, hey, this is a bug, but we can't repo it unless we need your code. Because like, clearly this is a bug, but we can't figure out how you're hitting it. Could you like, here's my email address, like call me, because I'd like to get a hold of your code if you can share it with me privately so we can like figure this out. It's fun. It's much more fun. You get to meet people a lot better. It's the direct contact is great. I mean, it doesn't occasionally have downside with abuse, but like overall, it's a win having that much more direct feedback. And our customers, we have plenty of evidence that our customers enjoy this too. As I said, when we moved to GitHub before that, we had this Visual Studio feedback system, and the volume of bugs that we used to get there was much higher. The moment we went to GitHub, we had a whole bunch of them disappear. The customers went, oh, they're on GitHub now, going to move this over there. And they were closing all their bugs for us and moving the bugs over to GitHub to talk to us over there. And that was, we thought, pretty amusing to see. And we enjoyed, like I said, we enjoyed it quite a bit.
Oh, that's nice. Any final notes before we wrap up for today, Jared?
I would just say that, like, you know, I've worked in C Sharp a long time. I'm a language polyglot. I love languages. I spend a lot of time outside of C Sharp. I do Go on the side. I do F Sharp. I back in the day, I used to learn a new language every year. Language design is fun. Compilers are fun. And I really hope people are enjoying our products. And I would say we have really enjoyed moving to GitHub and the participation we get there. And I'd really enjoy the amount of effort the community's put into like good issues and feedback and proposals. And I'd say, please keep them coming. Please keep talking to us. Some of our best ideas come from talking with customers.
Jared Parsons, thank you very much for your time today.
Awesome. Thanks for having me on.
If you like this episode, you might also like the other episodes on C#, with the likes of Matt Storgerson, Bill Wagner, Maria Nagaga, and others. There's a link in the show notes. Thank you. The opening music was Returned by Nisi23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Dog Days by Holizna from the album Summer Series.